quickly shuffles its DNA deck, hoping to generate some novel savior of a protein. Mammals have fewer transposons than plants. The immune system is one transposon hotspot in the enormous stretches of DNA coding for antibodies. A novel virus invades, shuffling the DNA increases the odds of coming up with an antibody that will target the invader. Footnote. And as a brilliant counter-strategy, some parasites use transposons to shuffle the DNA coding for their surface proteins every few weeks. In other words, just as the infected host is building up stocks of antibody to recognize the surface protein, the parasite switches identities, making the host's immune system start all over. The main point here is that transposons occur in the brain. In humans, transpositional events occur in stem cells in the brain when they are becoming neurons, making the brain a mosaic of neurons with different DNA sequences. In other words, when you make neurons, that boring DNA sequence you inherited isn't good enough. Remarkably, transpositional events occur in neurons that form memories in fruit flies. Even flies evolved such that their neurons are freed from the strict genetic marching orders they inherit. Chance. Finally, chance lessens genes as the code of codes. Chance, driven by Brownian motion, the random movement of particles in a fluid, has big effects on tiny things like molecules floating in cells, including molecules regulating gene transcription. This influences how quickly an activated TF reaches the DNA, splicing enzymes bump into target stretches of RNA, and an enzyme synthesizing something grabs the two precursor molecules needed for the synthesis. I'll stop here, otherwise I'll go on for hours. Some key points completing this part of the chapter. A. Genes are not autonomous agents commanding biological events. B. Instead, genes are regulated by the environment, with environment consisting of everything from events inside the cell to the universe. C. Much of your DNA turns environmental influences into gene transcription, rather than coding for genes themselves. Moreover, evolution is heavily about changing regulation of gene transcription rather than genes themselves. D. Epigenetics can allow environmental effects to be lifelong or even multigenerational. E. And thanks to transposons, neurons contain a mosaic of different genomes. In other words, genes don't determine much. This theme continues as we focus on the effects of genes on behavior. Part 2. Genes from the Top Down. Behavior Genetics. Long before anything was known about promoters, exons, or transcription factors, it became clear that you study genetics top down, by observing traits shared by relatives. Early in the last century, this emerged as the science of behavior genetics. As we'll see, the field has often been mired in controversy, typically because of disagreements over the magnitude of genetic effects on things like IQ or sexual orientation. First attempts. The field began with the primitive idea that if everyone in a family does it, it must be genetic. This was confounded by environment running in families as well. The next approach depended on closer relatives having more genes in common than distant ones. Thus, if a trait runs in a family and is more common among closer relatives, it's genetic. But obviously, closer relatives share more environment as well. Think of a child and parent versus a child and grandparent. Research grew subtler. Consider someone's biological aunt, i.e., the sister of a parent, and the uncle who married the aunt. The uncle shares some degree of environment with the individual, while the aunt shares the same, plus genes. Therefore, the extent to which the aunt is more similar to the individual than the uncle reflects the genetic influence. But as we'll see, this approach has problems. More sophistication was needed. Twins, adoptees, and adopted twins. A major advance came with twin studies. Initially, examining twins helped rule out the possibility of genetic determination of a behavior. Consider pairs of identical twins, sharing 100% of their genes. Suppose one of each pair has schizophrenia. Does the twin as well? If there are any cases where the other twin doesn't, i.e. where the concordance rate is less than 100%, you've shown that the genome and epigenetic profile inherited at birth do not solely determine the incidence of schizophrenia. In fact, the concordance rate is about 50%. But then a more elegant twin approach emerged, involving the key distinction between identical, monozygotic, or MZ twins, who share 100% of their genes, and fraternal, non-identical, dizygotic, or DZ twins, who, like all other sibling pairs, share 50% of their genes. Compare pairs of MZ twins with the same sex DZ twins. Each pair is the same age, was raised in the same environment, and shared a fetal environment. The only difference is the percentage of genes shared. Examine a trait occurring in one member of the twin pair. Is it there in the other? The logic ran that if a trait is shared more among MZ than among DZ twins, that increased degree of sharing reflects the genetic contribution to the trait. Another major advance came in the 1960s. Identify individuals adopted soon after birth. All they share with their biological parents is genes. All they share with their adoptive parents is environment. Thus, if adopted individuals share a trait more with their biological than with their adoptive parents, you've uncovered a genetic influence. This replicates a classic tool in animal studies, namely cross-fostering, switching newborn rat pups between two mothers. The approach was pioneered in revealing a strong genetic component to schizophrenia. Then came the most wonderful, amazing, like totally awesome thing ever in behavior genetics, started by Thomas Bouchard of the University of Minnesota. In 1979, Bouchard found a pair of identical twins who were, get this, separated at birth and adopted into different homes, with no knowledge of each other's existence until being reunited as adults. Identical twins separated at birth are so spectacular and rare that behavior geneticists swoon over them, want to collect them all. Bouchard eventually studied more than 100 such pairs. The attraction was obvious. Same genes, different environments, and the more different, the better. Thus, similarities in behavior probably reflect genetic influences. Here's an imaginary twin pair that would be God's gift to behavior geneticists. Identical twin boys separated at birth. One, Shmuel, is raised as an Orthodox Jew in the Amazon. The other, Wolfie, is raised as a Nazi in the Sahara. Reunite them as adults and see if they do similar quirky things like, say, flushing the toilet before using it. Flabbergastingly, one twin pair came close to that. They were born in 1933 in Trinidad to a German Catholic mother and a Jewish father. When the boys were 6 months of age, the parents separated. The mother returned to Germany with one son, and the other remained in Trinidad with the father. The latter was raised there and in Israel as Jack Yufa, an observant Jew whose first language was Yiddish. The other, Oskar Storr, was raised in Germany as a Hitler youth zealot. Reunited and studied by Bouchard, they warily got to know each other, discovering numerous shared behavioral and personality traits, including flushing the toilet before use. As we'll see, studies were more systematic than just documenting bathroom quirks. The flushing detail, however, always comes up in accounts of the pair. Behavior geneticists, wielding adoption and twin approaches, generated scads of studies, filling specialized journals like Genes, Brain, and Behavior, and Twin Research and Human Genetics. Collectively, the research consistently showed that genetics plays a major role in a gamut of domains of behavior, including IQ and its subcomponents, i.e. verbal ability and spatial ability, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar disorder, autism, attention deficit disorder, compulsive gambling, and alcoholism. Nearly as strong genetic influences were shown for personality measures related to extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, neuroticism, and openness to experience, known as the Big Five personality traits. Likewise, with genetic influences on degree of religiosity, attitude toward authority, attitude toward homosexuality, and propensities toward cooperation and risk-taking in games. Other twin studies show genetic influences on the likelihood of risky sexual behavior and on people's degree of attraction to secondary sexual characteristics, e.g. musculature in men, breast size in women. Meanwhile, some social scientists report genetic influences on the extent of political involvement and sophistication, independent of political orientation. There are behavior genetics papers in the American Journal of Political Science. Genes, genes everywhere. Large genetic contributions have even been uncovered for everything from the frequency with which teenagers text to the occurrence of dental phobias. So does this mean there is a gene for finding chest hair on guys to be hot, for likelihood of voting, for feelings about dentists? Vanishingly unlikely. Instead, gene and behavior are often connected by tortuous roots. Consider the genetic influence on voter participation. The mediating factor between the two turns out to be sense of control and efficacy. People who vote regularly feel that their actions matter, and this central locus of control reflects some genetically influenced personality traits, e.g., high optimism, low neuroticism. Or how about the link between genes and self-confidence? Some studies show that the intervening variable is genetic effects on height. Taller people are considered more attractive and treated better, boosting their self-confidence. Damn it. Footnote. Yeah, I'm shorter than average. In other words, genetic influences on behavior often work through very indirect routes, something rarely emphasized when news broadcasts toss out behavior genetics sound bites. Scientists report genetic influence on strategy when playing Candyland. The debates about twin and adoption studies. Many scientists have heavily criticized the assumptions in twin and adoption studies, showing that they generally lead to overestimates of the importance of genes. Most behavior geneticists recognize these problems, but argue that the overestimates are tiny. A summary of this technical but important debate. Criticism number one. Twin studies are premised on MZ and same-sex DZ twin pairs sharing environment equally, while sharing genes to very different extents. This equal environment assumption, EEA, is simply wrong. Starting with parents, MZ twins are treated more similarly than DZ twins, creating more similar environments for them. If this isn't recognized, greater similarity between MZs will be misattributed to genes. Scientists such as Kenneth Kendler of Virginia Commonwealth University, a dean of the field, have tried to control for this by A. quantifying just how similar childhoods were for twins with respect to variables like sharing rooms, clothing, friends, teachers, and adversity. B. examining cases of mistaken zygosity, where parents were wrong about their twins' MZ/DZ status, thus, for example, raising their DZ twins as if they were MZ, and C. comparing full, half, and step-siblings who were reared together for differing lengths of time. Most of these studies show that controlling for the assumption of MZs sharing more environment than do DZs doesn't significantly reduce the size of genetic influences. Hold that thought. Criticism number two. MZ twins experience life more similarly starting as fetuses. DZ twins are dichorionic, meaning that they have separate placentas. In contrast, 75% of MZ twins share one placenta, i.e. are monochorionic. Thus, most MZ twin fetuses share maternal blood flow more than do DZ twins, and thus are exposed to more similar levels of maternal hormones and nutrients. If that isn't recognized, greater similarity in MZs will be misattributed to genes. Various studies have determined what the chorionic status was in different MZ pairs and then examined endpoints related to cognition, personality, and psychiatric disease. By a small margin, most studies show that chorionic status does make a difference, leading to overestimates of genetic influence. How big of an overestimation? As stated in one review, small but not negligible. Criticism number 3. Recall that adoption studies assume that if a child is adopted soon after birth, she shares genes but no environment with her biological parents. But what about prenatal environmental effects? A newborn just spent 9 months sharing the circulatory environment with mom. Moreover, eggs and sperm can carry epigenetic changes into the next generation. If these various effects are ignored, an environmentally based similarity between mother and child would be misattributed to genes. Epigenetic transmission via sperm seems of small significance, but prenatal and epigenetic effects from the mother can be huge. For example, the Dutch hunger winter phenomenon showed that third trimester malnutrition increased the risk of some adult diseases more than tenfold. This confound can be controlled for. Roughly half your genes come from each parent, but prenatal environment comes from mom. Thus, traits shared more with biological mothers than with fathers argue against a genetic influence. The few tests of this, concerning the genetic influence on schizophrenia demonstrated in twin studies, suggest that prenatal effects aren't big. Criticism number 4. Adoption studies assume that a child and adoptive parents share environment but not genes. That might approach being true if adoption involved choosing adoptive parents randomly among everyone on Earth. Instead, adoption agencies prefer to place children with families of similar racial or ethnic background as the biological parents, a policy advocated by the National Association of Black Social Workers and the Child Welfare League. Thus, kids and adoptive parents typically share genes at a higher-than-chance level. If this isn't recognized, the similarity between them will be misattributed to environment. Researchers admit there is selective placement, but argue over whether it's consequential. This remains unsettled. Bouchard, with his twins separated at birth, controlled for cultural, material, and technological similarities between the separate homes of twin pairs, concluding that shared similarity of home environments due to selective placement was a negligible factor. A similar conclusion was reached in a larger study carried out by both Kendler and another dean of the field, Robert Plowman of King's College London. These conclusions have been challenged. The most fire-breathing critic has been Princeton psychologist Leon Kamen, who argues that concluding that selective placement isn't important is wrong because of misinterpretation of results, use of wimpy analytical tests, and over-reliance on questionable retrospective data. He wrote, "We suggest that no scientific purpose is served by the flood of heritability estimates generated by these studies." Here's where I give up. If super smart people who think about this issue all the time can't agree, I sure don't know how seriously selective placement distorts the literature. Criticism number 5. Adoptive parents tend to be more educated, wealthier, and more psychiatrically healthy than biological parents. Thus, adoptive households show range restriction, being more homogeneous than biological ones, which decreases the ability to detect environmental effects on behavior. Predictably, attempts to control for this satisfy only some critics. So what do we know after this slog through the criticisms and counter-criticisms about adoption and twin studies? Everyone agrees that confounds from prenatal environment, epigenetics, selective placement, range restriction, and assumptions about equal environment are unavoidable. Most of these confounds inflate the perceived importance of genes. Efforts have been made to control for these confounds and generally have shown that they are of less magnitude than charged by many critics. Crucially, these studies have mostly been about psychiatric disorders, which, while plenty interesting, aren't terribly relevant to the concerns of this book. In other words, no one has studied whether these confounds matter when considering genetic influences on, say, people's tendency to endorse their cultural's moral rules, yet rationalize why those rules don't apply to them today because they're stressed and it's their birthday. Lots more work to be done. The fragile nature of heritability estimates. Now starts a bruising, difficult, immensely important subject. I review its logic every time I teach it because it's so unintuitive, and I'm still always just words away from getting it wrong when I open my mouth in class. Behavior genetics studies usually produce a number called a heritability score. For example, studies have reported heritability scores in the 40 to 60% range for traits related to pro-social behavior, resilience after psychosocial stress, social responsiveness, political attitudes, aggression, and leadership potential. What's a heritability score? What does a gene do? Is at least two questions. How does a gene influence average levels of a trait? How does a gene influence variation among people in levels of that trait? These are crucially different. For example, how much do genes have to do with people's scores averaging 100 on this thing called an IQ test? Then, how much do genes have to do with one person scoring higher than another? Or how much do genes help in explaining why humans usually enjoy ice cream? How much in explaining why people like different flavors? These issues utilize two terms with similar sounds but different meanings. If genes strongly influence average levels of a trait, that trait is strongly inherited. If genes strongly influence the extent of variability around that average level, that trait has high heritability. It is a population measure, where a heritability score indicates the percentage of total variation attributable to genetics. The difference between an inherited trait and heritability generates at least two problems that inflate the putative influence of genes. First, people confuse the two terms. Things would be easier if heritability were called something like gene tendency and in a consistent direction. People often mistakenly believe that if a trait is strongly inherited, it's thus highly heritable. And it's particularly bad that confusion is typically in that direction because people are usually more interested in variability of traits among humans than in average levels of traits. For example, it's more interesting to consider why some people are smarter than others than why humans are smarter than turnips. The second problem is that research consistently inflates heritability measures, leading people to conclude that genes influence individual differences more than they do. Let's slowly work through this because it's really important. The difference between a trait being inherited and having a high degree of heritability. You can appreciate the difference by considering cases where they dissociate. First, an example of a trait that is highly inherited but has low heritability offered by the philosopher Ned Block. What do genes have to do with humans averaging 5 fingers per hand? Tons. It's an inherited trait. What do genes have to do with variation around that average? Not much. Cases of other than 5 fingers on a hand are mostly due to accidents. While average finger number is an inherited trait, the heritability of finger number is low. Genes don't explain individual differences much. Or stated differently, say you want to guess whether some organism's limb has 5 fingers or a hoof. Knowing their genetic makeup will help by identifying their species. Alternatively, you're trying to guess whether a particular person is likely to have 5 or 4 fingers on his hand. Knowing whether he uses buzz saws while blindfolded is more useful than knowing the sequence of his genome. Next, consider the opposite, a trait that is not highly inherited, but which has high heritability. What do genes directly have to do with humans being more likely than chimps to wear earrings? Not much. Now consider individual differences among humans. How much do genes help predict which individuals are wearing earrings at a high school dance in 1958? Tons. Basically, if you had 2 X chromosomes, you probably wore earrings. But if you had a Y chromosome, you wouldn't have been caught dead doing so. Thus, while genes had little to do with the prevalence of earrings among Americans in 1958 being around 50%, they had lots to do with determining which Americans wore them. Thus, in that time and place, wearing earrings, while not a strongly inherited trait, had high heritability. The reliability of heritability measures. We're now clear on the difference between inherited traits and their degree of heritability and recognized that people are usually more interested in the latter, you versus your neighbor, than the former, you versus a wildebeest. As we saw, SCADs of behavioral and personality traits have heritability scores of 40% to 60%, meaning that genetics explains about half the variability in the trait. The point of this section is that the nature of research typically inflates such scores. Say a plant geneticist sits in the desert studying a particular species of plant. In this imaginary scenario, a single gene, gene 3127, regulates the plant's growth. Gene 3127 comes in versions A, B, and C. Plants with version A always grow to be 1 inch tall. Version B, 2 inches, C, 3 inches. What single fact gives you the most power in predicting a plant's height? Obviously, whether it has version A, B, or C. That explains all the variation in height between plants, meaning 100% heritability. Meanwhile, 12,000 miles away in a rainforest, a second plant geneticist is studying a clone of that same plant. And in that environment, plants with version A, B, or C are 101, 102, or 103 inches tall, respectively. This geneticist also concludes that plant height in this case shows 100% heritability. Then, as required by the plot line, the two stand side by side at a conference, one brandishing 1, 2, 3 inch data, the other 101, 102, 103. They combine data sets. Now, you want to predict the height of one example of that plant taken from anywhere on the planet. You can either know which version of gene 3127 it possesses, or what environment it is growing in. Which is more useful? Knowing which environment. When you study this plant species in two environments, you discover that heritability of height is minuscule. Neon lights. This is crucial. Study a gene in only one environment, and by definition, you've eliminated the ability to see if it works differently in other environments. In other words, if other environments regulate the gene differently. And thus, you've artificially inflated the importance of the genetic contribution. The more environments in which you study a genetic trait, the more novel environmental effects will be revealed, decreasing the heritability score. Scientists study things in controlled settings to minimize variation in extraneous factors, and thus get cleaner, more interpretable results. For example, making sure that the plants all have their height measured around the same time of year. This inflates heritability scores, because you've prevented yourself from ever discovering that some extraneous environmental factor isn't actually extraneous. Thus, a heritability score tells how much variation in a trait is explained by genes in the environments in which it's been studied. As you study the trait in more environments, the heritability score will decrease. This is recognized by Bouchard. These conclusions, derived from a behavior genetic study, can be generalized, of course, only to new populations exposed to a range of environments similar to those studied. Okay, that was slick on my part, inventing a plant that grows in both desert and rainforest just to trash heritability scores. Real plants rarely occur in both of those environments. Instead, in one rainforest, the three gene versions might produce plants of heights 1, 2, and 3 inches, while in another they are 1.1, 2.1, and 3.1, producing a heritability score that, while less than 100%, is still extremely high. Genes typically still play hefty roles in explaining individual variability, given that any given species lives in a limited range of environments. Capybaras stick to the tropics, polar bears to the Arctic. This business about heterogeneous environments driving down heritability scores is important only in considering some hypothetical species that, say, lives in both tundra and desert, in various population densities, in nomadic bands, sedentary farming communities, and urban apartment buildings. Oh, that's right. Humans. Of all species, heritability scores in humans plummet the most when shifting from a controlled experimental setting to considering the species' full range of habitats. Just consider how much the heritability score for wearing earrings, with its gender split, has declined since 1958. Now to consider an extremely important complication. Gene-environment interactions. Back to our plant. Imagine a growth pattern in environment A of 1, 1, and 1 for the three gene variants, while in environment B it's 10, 10, and 10. When considering the combined data from both environments, heritability is zero. Variation is entirely explained by which environment the plant grew in. Now instead, in environment A, it's 1, 2, and 3, while in environment B, it's also 1, 2, and 3. Heritability is 100%, with all variability in height explained by genetic variation. Now say environment A is 1, 2, and 3, and environment B is 1.5, 2.5, 3.5. Heritability is somewhere between 0% and 100%. Now for something different. Environment A, 1, 2, 3. Environment B, 3, 2, 1. In this case, even talking about a heritability score is problematic because different gene variants have diametrically opposite effects in different environments. We have an example of a central concept in genetics, a gene-environment interaction, where qualitative rather than just quantitative effects of a gene differ by environment. Here's a rule of thumb for recognizing gene-environment interactions, translated into English. You are studying the behavioral effects of a gene in two environments. Someone asks, "What are the effects of the gene on some behavior?" You answer, "It depends on the environment." Then they ask, "What are the effects of environment on this behavior?" And you answer, "It depends on the version of the gene." It depends equals a gene-environment interaction. Here are some classic examples concerning behavior. The disease phenylketonuria arises from a single gene mutation. Skipping over details, the mutation disables an enzyme that converts a potentially neurotoxic dietary constituent, phenylalanine, into something safe. Thus, if you eat a normal diet, phenylalanine accumulates, damaging the brain. But eat a phenylalanine-free diet from birth, and there is no damage. What are the effects of this mutation on brain development? It depends on your diet. What's the effect of diet on brain development? It depends on whether you have this rare mutation. Another gene-environment interaction pertains to depression, a disease involving serotonin abnormalities. A gene called 5-HTT codes for a transporter that removes serotonin from the synapse. Having a particular 5-HTT variant increases the risk of depression, but only when coupled with childhood trauma. What's the effect of 5-HTT variant on depression risk? It depends on childhood trauma exposure. What's the effect of childhood trauma exposure on depression risk? It depends on 5-HTT variant, plus loads of other genes, but you get the point. Another example concerns FADS2, a gene involved in fat metabolism. One variant is associated with higher IQ, but only in breastfed children. Same pair of what's the effect questions, same it depends answers. One final gene-environment interaction was revealed in an important 1999 Science paper. The study was a collaboration among three behavioral geneticists, one at Oregon Health Sciences University, one at the University of Alberta, and one at the State University of New York in Albany. They studied mouse strains known to have genetic variants relevant to particular behaviors, e.g. addiction or anxiety. First, they ensured that the mice from a particular strain were essentially genetically identical in all three labs. Then the scientists did cartwheels to test the animals in identical conditions in the labs. They standardized everything, because some mice were born in the lab, but others came from breeders. Homegrowns were given bouncy van rides to simulate the jostling that commercially bred mice undergo during shipping, just in case that was important. Animals were tested at the same day of age, on the same date, at the same local time. Animals had been weaned at the same age and lived in the same brand of cage with the same brand and thickness of sawdust bedding changed on the same day of the week. They were handled the same number of times by humans wearing the same brand of surgical gloves. They were fed the same food and kept in the same lighting environment at the same temperature. The environments of these animals could hardly have been more similar if the three scientists had been identical triplets separated at birth. What did they observe? Some gene variants showed massive gene-environment interactions, with variants having radically different effects in different labs. Here's the sort of data they got. Take a strain called 129/SVEVTAC and a test measuring the effects of cocaine on activity. In Oregon, cocaine increased activity in these mice by 667 centimeters of movement per 15 minutes. In Albany, an increase of 701. Those are pretty similar numbers. Good. And in Alberta? More than 5,000. That's like identical triplets pole vaulting, each in a different location. They've all had the same training, equipment, running surface, night's rest, breakfast, and brand of underwear. The first two vault 18 feet and 18 feet 1 inch, and the third vaults 108 feet. Maybe the scientists didn't know what they were doing. Maybe the labs were chaotic. But variability was small within each lab, showing stable environmental conditions. And crucially, a few variants didn't show a gene-environment interaction, producing similar effects in the three labs. What does this mean? That most of the gene variants were so sensitive to environment that gene-environment interactions occurred even in these obsessively similar lab settings, where incredibly subtle and still unidentified environmental differences made huge differences in what the gene did. Citing gene-environment interactions is a time-honored genetics cliche. My students roll their eyes when I mention them. I roll my eyes when I mention them. Eat your vegetables, floss your teeth. Remember to say, it's difficult to quantitatively assess the relative contributions of genes and environment to a particular trait when they interact. This suggests a radical conclusion. It's not meaningful to ask what a gene does, just what it does in a particular environment. This is summarized wonderfully by the neurobiologist Donald Hebb. It is no more appropriate to say things like, characteristic A is more influenced by nature than nurture than to say that the area of a rectangle is more influenced by its length than its width. It's appropriate to figure out if lengths or widths explain more of the variability in a population of rectangles, but not in individual ones. As we conclude part two of this chapter, some key points. A gene's influence on the average value of a trait, i.e., whether it is inherited, differs from its influence on variability of that trait across individuals, its heritability. B. Even in the realm of inherited traits, say the inheritance of five fingers as the human average, you can't really say that there is genetic determination in the classically hard-assed sense of the word. This is because the inheritance of a gene's effect requires not just passing on the gene, but also the context that regulates the gene in that manner. C. Heritability scores are relevant only to the environments in which the traits have been studied. The more environments you study a trait in, the lower the heritability is likely to be. D. Gene-environment interactions are ubiquitous and can be dramatic. Thus, you can't really say what a gene does, only what it does in the environments in which it's been studied. Current research actively explores gene-environment interactions. How's this for fascinating? Heritability of various aspects of cognitive development is very high, e.g., around 70% for IQ, in kids from high socioeconomic status, SES, families, but is only around 10% in low SES kids. Thus, higher SES allows the full range of genetic influences on cognition to flourish, whereas lower SES settings restrict them. In other words, genes are nearly irrelevant to cognitive development if you're growing up in awful poverty. Poverty's adverse effects, trump the genetics. Similarly, heritability of alcohol use is lower among religious than non-religious subjects, i.e., your genes don't matter much if you're in a religious environment that condemns drinking. Domains like these showcase the potential power of classical behavior genetics. Part 3. So what do genes actually have to do with behaviors we're interested in? The marriage of behavior genetics and molecular genetics. Behavior genetics has gotten a huge boost by incorporating molecular approaches. After examining similarities and differences between twins or adoptees, find the actual genes that underlie those similarities and differences. This powerful approach has identified various genes relevant to our interests. But first, our usual caveats. A. Not all of these findings consistently replicate. B. Effect sizes are typically small. In other words, some gene may be involved, but not in a major way. And C. The most interesting findings show gene-environment interactions. Studying candidate genes. Gene searches can take a candidate approach or a genome-wide association approach. Stay tuned. The former requires a list of plausible suspects, genes already known to be related to some behavior. For example, if you're interested in a behavior that involves serotonin, obvious candidate genes would include those coding for enzymes that make or degrade serotonin, pumps that remove it from the synapse, or serotonin receptors. Pick one that interests you and study it in animals using molecular tools to generate knockout mice where you've eliminated that gene or transgenic mice with an extra copy of the gene. Make manipulations like these only in certain brain regions or at certain times. Then examine what's different about behavior. Once you're convinced of an effect, ask whether variants of that gene help explain individual differences in human versions of the behavior. I start with a topic that has gotten the most attention, for better or worse, mostly worse. The serotonin system. What do genes related to serotonin have to do with our best and worst behaviors? Plenty. Chapter 2 presented a fairly clear picture of low levels of serotonin fostering impulsive antisocial behavior. There are lower than average levels of serotonin breakdown products in the bloodstreams of people with that profile and of serotonin itself in the frontal cortex of such animals. Even more convincingly, drugs that decrease serotonergic tone, i.e. decreasing serotonin levels or sensitivity to serotonin, increase impulsive aggression. Raising the tone does the opposite. This generates some simple predictions. All of the following should be associated with impulsive aggression, as they will produce low serotonin signaling. A. Low activity variants of the gene for tryptophan hydroxylase, TH, which makes serotonin. B. High activity variants of the gene for monoamine oxidase A, MAOA, which degrades serotonin. C. High activity variants of the gene for the serotonin transporter 5-HTT, which removes serotonin from the synapse. D. Variants of genes for serotonin receptors that are less sensitive to serotonin. An extensive literature shows that for each of those genes, the results are inconsistent and generally go in the opposite direction from low serotonin equals aggression dogma. Ugh. Studies of genes for TH and serotonin receptors are inconsistent messes. In contrast, the picture of 5-HTT, the serotonin transporter gene, is consistently in the opposite direction from what's expected. Two variants exist, with one producing less transporter protein, meaning less serotonin removed from the synapse. And counter to expectations, this variant, producing more serotonin in the synapse, is associated with more impulsive aggression, not less. Thus, according to these findings, high serotonin equals aggression, recognizing this as simplified shorthand. The clearest and most counterintuitive studies concern MAOA. It burst on the scene in a hugely influential 1993 science paper reporting a Dutch family with an MAOA gene mutation that eliminated the protein. Thus, serotonin isn't broken down and accumulates in the synapse. And counter to Chapter 2's predictions, the family was characterized by varied antisocial and aggressive behaviors. Mouse studies in which the MAOA gene was knocked out, producing the equivalent of the Dutch family's mutation, produced the same. Elevated serotonin levels in the synapse and hyperaggressive animals with enhanced fear responses. This finding, of course, concerned a mutation in MAOA, resulting in the complete absence of the protein. Research soon focused on low-activity MAOA variants that produced elevated serotonin levels. People with that variant averaged higher levels of aggression and impulsivity and, when looking at angry or fearful faces, more activation of the amygdala and insula, and less activation of the prefrontal cortex. This suggests a scenario of more fear reactivity and less frontal capacity to restrain such fear, a perfect storm for reactive aggression. Related studies showed decreased activation of frontal cortical regions during various attentional tasks and enhanced anterior cingulate activity in response to social rejection in such individuals. So studies where serotonin breakdown products are measured in the body, or where serotonin levels are manipulated with drugs, say that low serotonin equals aggression. And the genetic studies, particularly of MAOA, say high serotonin equals aggression. What explains this discrepancy? The key, probably, is that a drug manipulation lasts for a few hours or days, while genetic variants have their effects on serotonin for a lifetime. Possible explanations? A. The low-activity MAOA variants don't produce higher synaptic levels of serotonin all that consistently because the 5-HTT serotonin reuptake pump works harder at removing serotonin from the synapse, compensating, and maybe even overcompensating. There is evidence for this, just to make life really complicated. B. Those variants do produce chronically elevated serotonin levels in the synapse, but the postsynaptic neurons compensate or overcompensate by decreasing serotonin receptor numbers, thereby reducing sensitivity to all that serotonin. There is evidence for that too. C. The lifelong consequences of differences in serotonin signaling due to gene variants versus transient differences due to drugs produce structural changes in the developing brain. There is evidence there as well, and in accordance with that, while temporarily inhibiting MAOA activity with a drug in an adult rodent decreases impulsive aggression. Doing the same in fetal rodents produces adults with increased impulsive aggression. Yikes, this is complicated. Why go through the agony of all these explanatory twists and turns? Because this obscure corner of neurogenetics has caught the public's fancy with, I kid you not, the low-activity MAOA variant being referred to as the warrior gene by both scientists and in the media. And that warrior hoo-ha is worsened by the MAOA gene being X-linked and its variants being more consequential in males than females. Amazingly, prison sentences for murderers have now been lessened in at least two cases because it was argued that the criminal, having the warrior gene variant of MAOA, was inevitably fated to be uncontrollably violent. OMG. Responsible people in the field have recoiled in horror at this sort of unfounded genetic determinism seeping into the courtroom. The effects of MAOA variants are tiny. There is non-specificity in the sense that MAOA degrades not only serotonin but norepinephrine as well. Most of all, there is non-specificity in the behavioral effects of the variants. For example, while nearly everyone seems to remember that the landmark MAOA paper that started all the excitement was about aggression, one authoritative review referred to the Dutch family with a mutation as notorious for the persistent and extreme reactive aggression demonstrated by some of its males. In actuality, members of the family with a mutation had borderline mental retardation. Moreover, while some individuals with a mutation were quite violent, the antisocial behavior of others consisted of arson and exhibitionism. So maybe the gene has something to do with the extreme reactive aggression of some family members. But it is just as responsible for explaining why other family members, rather than being aggressive, were flashers. In other words, there is as much rationale for going on about the drop-your-pants gene as the warrior gene. Probably the biggest reason to reject warrior gene determinism nonsense is something that should be utterly predictable by now. MAOA effects on behavior show strong gene-environment interactions. This brings us to a hugely important 2002 study, one of my favorites, by Avshalom Kaspi and colleagues at Duke University. The authors followed a large cohort of children from birth to age 26, studying their genetics, upbringing, and adult behavior. Did MAOA variant status predict antisocial behavior in 26-year-olds, as measured by a composite of standard psychological assessments and convictions for violent crimes? No. But MAOA status coupled with something else powerfully did. Having the low activity version of MAOA tripled the likelihood, but only in people with a history of severe childhood abuse. And if there was no such history, the variant was not predictive of anything. This is the essence of gene-environment interaction. What does having a particular variant of the MAOA gene have to do with antisocial behavior? It depends on the environment. Warrior gene, my ass. This study is important not just for its demonstration of a powerful gene-environment interaction, but for what the interaction is, namely, the ability of an abusive childhood environment to collaborate with a particular genetic constitution. To quote a major review on the subject, in a healthy environment, increased threat sensitivity, poor emotion control, and enhanced fear memory in MAOAL, i.e. the warrior variant, men, might only manifest as variation in temperament within a normal or subclinical range. However, these same characteristics in an abusive childhood environment, one typified by persistent uncertainty, unpredictable threat, poor behavioral modeling and social referencing, and inconsistent reinforcement for pro-social decision-making, might predispose toward frank aggression and impulsive violence in the adult. In a similar vein, the low-activity variant of the serotonin transporter gene was reported to be associated with adult aggressiveness, but only when coupled with childhood adversity. This is straight out of the lessons of the previous chapter. Since then, this MAOA variant, childhood abuse interaction, has been frequently replicated and even demonstrated with respect to aggressive behavior in rhesus monkeys. There have also been hints as to how this interaction works. The MAOA gene promoter is regulated by stress and glucocorticoids. MAOA variants show other important gene-environment interactions. For example, in one study, the low-activity MAOA variant predicts criminality, but only if coupled with high testosterone levels. Consistent with that, the MAOA gene also has a promoter responsive to androgens. In another study, low-activity MAOA participants in an economic game were more likely than high-activity ones to retaliate aggressively when exploited by the other player, but only if that exploitation produced a large economic loss. If the loss was small, there was no difference. In another study, low-activity individuals were more aggressive than others, but only in circumstances of social exclusion. Thus, the effects of this genetic variant can be understood only by considering other non-genetic factors in individuals' lives, such as childhood adversity and adult provocation. The dopamine system. Chapter 2 introduced the role of dopamine in the anticipation of reward and in goal-directed behavior. Lots of work has examined the genes involved, most broadly showing that variants that produce lower dopamine signaling, less dopamine in the synapse, fewer dopamine receptors, or lower responsiveness of these receptors, are associated with sensation-seeking, risk-taking, attentional problems, and extroversion. Such individuals have to seek experiences of greater intensity to compensate for the blunted dopamine signaling. Much of the research has focused on one particular dopamine receptor. There are at least five kinds, found in different parts of the brain, binding dopamine with differing strengths and duration, each coded for by a gene. Work has focused on the gene for the D4 dopamine receptor. The gene is called DRD4, which mostly occurs in the neurons in the cortex and nucleus accumbens. The DRD4 gene is supervariable, coming in at least 10 different flavors in humans. One stretch of the gene is repeated a variable number of times, and the version with 7 repeats, the 7R form, produces a receptor protein that is sparse in the cortex and relatively unresponsive to dopamine. This is the variant associated with a host of related traits: sensation and novelty seeking, extroversion, alcoholism, promiscuity, less sensitive parenting, financial risk-taking, impulsivity, and, probably most consistently, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The implications cut both ways. The 7R could make you more likely to impulsively steal the old lady's kidney dialysis machine, or to impulsively give the deed of your house to a homeless family. In come gene-environment interactions. For example, kids with a 7R variant are less generous than average, but only if they show insecure attachment to their parents. Secure attachment 7Rs show more generosity than average. Thus, 7R has something to do with generosity, but its effect is entirely context-dependent. In another study, 7R students expressed the least interest in organizations advocating pro-social causes unless they were given a religious prime, in which case they were the most pro-social. One more. 7Rs are worse at gratification postponement tasks, but only if they grew up poor. Repeat the mantra. Don't ask what a gene does. Ask what it does in a particular context. Interestingly, the next chapter considers the extremely varied frequency of the 7R variant in different populations. As we'll see, it tells you a lot about the history of human migration, as well as about differences between collectivist and individualist cultures. We shift now to other parts of the dopamine system. As introduced in Chapter 2, after dopamine binds to receptors, it floats off and must be removed from the synapse. One route involves its being degraded by the enzyme catechol-O-methyltransferase, COMT. Among the variants of the COMT gene is one associated with a more efficient enzyme. More efficient equals better at degrading dopamine equals less dopamine in the synapse equals less dopamine signaling. The highly efficient COMT variant is associated with higher rates of extroversion, aggression, criminality, and conduct disorder. Moreover, in a gene-environment interaction straight out of the MAOA playbook, that COMT variant is associated with anger traits, but only when coupled with childhood sexual abuse. Intriguingly, the variants seem pertinent to frontal regulation of behavior and cognition, especially during stress. In addition to degradation, neurotransmitters can be removed from the synapse by being taken back up into the axon terminal for recycling. Dopamine reuptake is accomplished by the dopamine transporter, DAT. Naturally, the DAT gene comes in different variants, and those that produce higher levels of synaptic dopamine, i.e. transporter variants that are less efficient, in the striatum, are associated with people who are more oriented towards social signaling. They're drawn more than average to happy faces, are more repelled by angry faces, and have more positive parenting styles. How these findings merge with the findings from the DRD4 and COMT studies, i.e. fitting risk-taking with a preference for happy faces, is not immediately apparent. Cool people with certain versions of these dopamine-related genes are more likely to engage in all sorts of interesting behaviors, ranging from the healthy to the pathological. But not so fast. These findings are not consistent, no doubt reflecting unrecognized gene-environment interactions. Again, why should the COMT world be related to sensation-seeking, while there are the DAT people and their happy faces? Both genes are about ending dopamine signaling. This is probably related to different parts of the brain differing as to whether DAT or COMT plays a bigger role. The COMT literature is majorly messy, for the inconvenient reason that the enzyme also degrades norepinephrine. So COMT variants are pertinent to two totally different neurotransmitter systems. These effects are tiny. For example, knowing which DRD4 variant someone has explains only 3-4% of the variation in novelty-seeking behavior. The final piece of confusion seems most important but is least considered in the literature, probably because it would be premature. Suppose that every study shows with whopping clarity and consistency that a DRD4 variant is highly predictive of novelty-seeking. That still doesn't tell us why, for some people, novelty-seeking means frequently switching their openings in chess games, while for others it means looking for a new locale because it's getting stale being a mercenary in the Congo. No gene, or handful of genes that we are aware of, will tell us much about that. The neuropeptides oxytocin and vasopressin. Time for a quick recap from Chapter 4. Oxytocin and vasopressin are involved in prosociality, ranging from parent-offspring bonds to monogamous bonds to trust, empathy, generosity, and social intelligence. Recall the caveats. A. Sometimes these neuropeptides are more about sociality than prosociality. In other words, boosting social information gathering rather than acting prosocially with that information. B. They most consistently boost prosociality in people who already lean in that direction, e.g., making generous people more generous while having no effect on ungenerous people. And C. The prosocial effects are within groups, and these neuropeptides can make people crappier to outsiders, more xenophobic and preemptively aggressive. Chapter 4 also touched on oxytocin and vasopressin genetics, showing that individuals with genetic variants that result in higher levels of either the hormones or their receptors tend toward more stable, monogamous relationships, more actively engaged parenting, better skill at perspective taking, more empathy, and stronger fusiform cortex responses to faces. These are fairly consistent effects of moderate magnitude. Meanwhile, there are studies showing that one oxytocin receptor gene variant is associated with extreme aggression in kids, as well as a callous, unemotional style that foreshadows adult psychopathy. Moreover, another variant is associated with social disconnection in kids and unstable adult relationships. But unfortunately, these findings are uninterpretable because no one knows if these variants produce more, less, or the usual amount of oxytocin signaling. Of course, there are cool gene-environment interactions. For example, having a particular oxytocin receptor gene variant predicts less sensitive mothering, but only when coupled with childhood adversity. Another variant is associated with aggression, but only when people have been drinking. Yet another variant is associated with greater seeking of emotional support during times of stress, among Americans, including first-generation Korean Americans, but not Koreans. Stay tuned for more in the next chapter. Genes related to steroid hormones. We start with testosterone. The hormone is not a protein, none of the steroid hormones are, meaning there isn't a testosterone gene. However, there are genes for the enzymes that construct testosterone, for the enzyme that converts it to estrogen, and for the testosterone androgen receptor. The most work is focused on the gene for the receptor, which comes in variants that differ in their responsiveness to testosterone. Footnote: for aficionados, the testosterone receptor contains what is called a polyglutamine repeat, a stretch of the protein where the same amino acid, called glutamine, is repeated. Importantly, there is tremendous variability among people as to how many glutamine repeats there are. The fewer, the more potently the androgen receptor works. Recall that receptors for steroid hormones like testosterone work as transcription factors, and proteins that have polyglutamine repeats are often transcription factors. Intriguingly, a few studies have shown that among criminals, having the more potent variant is associated with violent crimes. A related finding concerns sex differences in structure of the cortex, and adolescent boys with the more potent variant show more dramatic masculinization of the cortex. An interaction between receptor variant and testosterone levels occurs. High basal testosterone levels do not predict elevated levels of aggressive mood or of amygdaloid reactivity to threatening faces in males, except in those with that variant. Interestingly, the equivalent variant predicts aggressiveness in Akita dogs. How important are these findings? A key theme in Chapter 4 was how little individual differences in testosterone levels in the normal range predict individual differences in behavior. How much more predictability is there when combining knowledge of testosterone levels and of receptor sensitivity? Not much. How about hormone levels and receptor sensitivity and number of receptors? Still not much, but definitely an improvement in predictive power. Similar themes concern the genetics of the estrogen receptor. For example, different receptor variants are associated with higher rates of anxiety among women, but not men, and higher rates of antisocial behavior and conduct disorder in men, but not women. Meanwhile, in